seeking for the eternal. Among the scriptures, the testimonies, and the instructions that are given in the Vedantic tradition, two of the most extraordinary are the two oldest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya. No one knows exactly when these originated. They were not written down initially. But the profundity of the teaching and the directness of the teaching is startling in some respects. These teachings were originally given in forest hermitages. That is, people used to go and listen to these monks and devotees who had settled in the forests and were spending their lives in studying scriptures and practicing spiritual disciplines. And people used to come and listen to them, and there would be assemblies also of experts, assemblies of pundits and teachers. Discussions would take place. This was the normal situation in those ancient days. Nobody knows exactly when that was. Several thousand years ago, certainly. And of these two, I wanted to concentrate today on aspects of the Chandogya Upanishad, because the explanations or the teachings given there seem to be to get to the very difficult points that everyone has trouble understanding or appreciating or actually practicing and realizing. And one of the teachings that is sort of the source of thought or the source of our considerations on these matters is sarvam khalidam brahma. Sarvam, everything, khalu, indeed, brahma. Everything is really Brahman. What is Brahman? But the extraordinary thing about it is the statement is made that everything, meaning everything we perceive, everything we see, everything we experience, is one reality. Now, the basis of our life is to see differences. Everything that children are taught from the very youngest days is to see differences. That one should be able to distinguish one thing from another, something that's helpful from something that's hurtful. Even animals teach their young that certain things should be done and certain things are dangerous if you do them. But that ability which is taught to young people and even to young animals by their parents, this seems to be turned upside down with this statement. Everything is really Brahman. In other words, you are paying attention to all the differences. But the truth of the matter is that there is no difference. So how does that make any sense? In order to live in this world, we have to see differences. If you are moving along on a roadway and there's a light up there, it makes a lot of difference whether that light is red or green. And we have to understand that difference. Otherwise, consequences can be disastrous. And this is just, everything seems to be like that. We can navigate in this world because we see differences. If I see no difference between a stairway and a flat floor, I will tumble and cause myself harm. In every aspect, we are taught to precisely see differences. And science is based on that. Science is based on the seeing of differences, on the seeing of subtle nuances in difference that might escape the ordinary observer. But if you notice those subtle differences, it becomes a very fruitful thought and very fruitful action resulting from that thought. So everything seems to be dependent on the seeing of differences and carefully analyzing it, categorizing it, understanding the implications of it. That is the whole of education seems to be concentrated on that. Now, this thing turns everything upside down. This statement, if you want to understand the spiritual truth as apart from navigation in this world, the essential thing is to see what is the same here. What is it that is not different from one thing to another? So we can't say, why should it be like that? It should be the other way. One should be able to reconcile these two things, but they seem to be irreconcilable because they lead to different ends. And the Upanishads, of course, also point out that if you look at things and you see, again, one difference it makes is between what is good and what is pleasant. There's another Upanishad that focuses on the difference, on seeing the difference. When we're faced with anything, seeing the difference between what is good for us and what is pleasant for us. And the statement is made, those who follow what is good for us, they go to greater development. And those who go after that which is pleasant as an object of search or as an intent, eventually they will run into ever-increasing difficulties. So the path of religion seems to be a difference of approach, a total difference of approach. And that we have to understand. So then the question comes, are there two kinds of strivings or two kinds of people, those who pursue one and those who pursue the other? Now, each person has to determine that in their own life, what is good and what is pleasant. It's not that one should renounce the pleasant entirely, one should only adhere to what is good. Sometimes what is good is also pleasant. But what is it that we're aiming for? What is our ultimate goal? And frequently the trouble in our life is that we don't see that difference. So that is one aspect on the psychological level, to determine that and to go after that which is good. rather than that which is pleasant. Now, primarily, as I said, some things are good and pleasant also. Then we have to exercise further discrimination. But as a basic principle, the Upanishads put that before us. Now, there's another idea. What is it that we're looking at? What is this thing that, this universe, this world that we're facing? Somehow we seem to have been put in this universe. We don't seem to know why. Of course, we analyze that, we find it. There is a reason we are where we are, doing what we're doing, being what we are. There are reasons. That brings in the law of karma, the law of cause and effect. But the basic question is, what is it that we came here to understand? What is it that we came here to do? Was there any purpose here, or is this just all an accident, fortuitous or unfortuitous, depending on how you look at it, coincidence? So they say, no, it is not a coincidence, it is something which we have been working on. The basic principle here is that this is not the only time we're facing this universe. The idea of reincarnation is at the core of it all. If there is no reincarnation, then the whole picture changes. And it becomes a very dreadful, for some people, a very dreadful place. For some other people, a very helpful place. But dreadful or helpful, all of them end, life ends, and then we are faced with a huge question, what happens afterwards, which is related to the other question of what happened before. Why are we where we are? And why are we going where we are going? All these questions naturally arise, and the solutions, the idea of reincarnation and all those ideas have been accepted by vast populations in the world for untold ages. The Buddhists have accepted it, the Hindus have accepted it, the Christians also, it seems, initially also had these ideas. But at some church council, sometime in the early history of the church, it was decided that that was not appropriate and that idea was dropped. Anyway, the subject today is searching for the eternal, and the only way that can make sense is if we are partaking of that eternity also. If we were not eternal, if we are here for a while and then we simply disappear, and if we started from nothing, that is, before our birth is a complete blank, then after we pass away, it's also a complete blank, and the whole question becomes merely academic, because it's not going to make any difference. It'll only be blank. There'll only be a blank in the end. So, the teaching of the Upanishad in terms of what it is, what is our condition in this world, where do we come from, where are we going, what is it that impels us, what is the source, what is the goal, what are we supposed to do here? Oh yes, of course, we are told we have to get an education, we have to have a family, we have to raise a family, and all of those things are there, and that is fine. But there's always a point at the end when everything disappears. So the whole thing hangs together for a short while, but it's drifting in empty space. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know where it goes. The Upanishads tackle those questions. And the answer they give is very simple, but extremely difficult to surround our mind around, to think about. But the idea is very simple. Really, there is no multiplicity here at all. And that doesn't make any sense because we see only multiplicity, and all our life is dependent on that multiplicity. But the basic statement made is that there is no multiplicity. There is only one infinite reality. And all the religions will maintain there is an infinite reality, but they will not necessarily say that's the only thing. There are also things that come and go. But the thing that is at the foundation of the teachings of Vedanta is that the things that come and go are also at heart, that reality only, which is viewed in a partial way, in an incomplete way, as something finite. If we see the reality of things in their true nature, we will find there is no coming and going. There is no multiplicity. And the idea of meditation is basically that. The teachings of meditation are basically contained in that one aphorism of Patanjali defining what yoga is. Yoga is chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the quieting, the control of the waves of the mind. The vrittis, the tendencies, the waves in the mind. Control that is what we're trying to do. And then the question is, what do we gain by that, in that control? If we're able to completely control that, if we're able to achieve that goal, what is it that is realized? So the Upanishads give that answer. Or they tell us, give us the clues as to how to reach that state. And the idea of meditation is to reach that state where we understand these things. All these issues are not just theoretical things that are waved in the air by people who have discovered these truths, but there's nothing we can do to realize them ourselves. No, the point of meditation is to enable us to understand what they understood, to live up to what they lived up to realize what they realized. And some of that can be even realized before we actually achieve anything deep and profound. The mind, the intellect, can surround these issues. Manasai vedam aptavyam. Manasa, by the mind, this can be aptavyam, this can be reached, this can be understood. What is it that can be understood? Neha na nasti kinchana. Na iha. Neha. Na iha. Not here. Nana, multiplicity, asti is, kinchana, not in the slightest. Multiplicity does not exist here in the slightest. Isn't that an outstanding, a very astonishing, extraordinary statement? There is no multiplicity here. That is the message of Vedanta. There is no multiplicity here. What is here is beyond words, beyond speech. Avang manasagotaram. It's vak and manas. It is beyond the gotara, beyond the reach of mind and speech. But it can be experienced. Many of our deepest things are beyond the reach of mind and speech. The love that we feel, how are you going to describe that? One person says to another, my dear, I love you. The mother says to her child, my dear, I love you. What do they mean by that? The child understands what the mother means, and the mother understands what she means. But if you try to explain that, you simply have to stutter a little bit here and there. You cannot explain it. So these deepest truths, these deepest understandings are not expressible in words, but they can be experienced, they can be understood, they can be lived. So there is no multiplicity here. So, okay, there's no multiplicity. Well, what is it that is here? Because we feel that there is something here. What is that? That is the infinite and the eternal. Sarvam Kalu Idam Brahma. All of this really is Brahman. Brahman is, what is Brahman? Sat Chit Ananda. It is existence. We exist. Our feeling of existence within us is a manifestation of God, a manifestation of that infinity. Chit, the consciousness within us, is a manifestation of God, of the infinite. It's as if you jumped into the water with all, you know, wearing whatever clothing, and all your clothing got wet. It was all part of you still, but it was all you. It is different from you, but all of you are soaked with water. Everything is filled, is immersed in water, is soaked in water. So these are the ideas that we have to try to understand, to grapple with. If everything is divine, if everything is really, I mean, if God is a reality in this world, and if by achieving that quietness of the vrittis of the waves in the mind, by achieving that we can realize it, then we should be able to describe it in some way. Yes, God is beyond description, the infinite and the eternal. You can, avang manasagotaram, is beyond the range of mind and speech. But that is not acceptable. If something is beyond the range of mind and speech, it doesn't mean it can't be experienced. Because we do experience that. If we put, as we were saying, the love between a mother and her child, you cannot describe it. You cannot say exactly in any precise way what is constituted of, but everyone who has experienced it will understand it. In the same sense, those people who have experienced that divine reality, they understand what it is, but they can't explain it. In this, the original translation of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna by M., this Sri Ramakrishna is quoted as making this statement that when you come down from that state of experience, you cannot describe it. It's beyond words. And when you're on the human side of that divine experience, you can't explain it either. You can say, well, it's beyond mind and speech or like that. You can make all these statements, but what it really is, you can't expect. All you know, it's a highly desirable state, so you try might and main to reach it. But when you reach it, you know exactly what it is. But if you try to explain someone afterwards what you've experienced, you can only stutter. Well, it was like this, or it was huge, or it was absolutely incredible, or I felt like I was like this and that. You could make all these statements, which will mean absolutely nothing to anybody else. But for you, it's you have in mind exactly what you're trying to describe, but you can't convey that. So Sri Ramakrishna said, when a person comes down from that state, even though he has experienced it and he is fully conscious and immersed in it, he can't make it really clear to anybody else. So this is, in other words, this is something you can't write books about. You can hint at it, as the Upanishads have done. But to actually get that experience, you have to get into that practice, and you have to head in that direction, and you have to, as you head toward it, you get little hints and tiny little glimpses, like the sun, or before the sunrise over the horizon, you can see a little bit of red, the clouds begin to glow red, you get some faint idea. But actually, when the full sun rises, it is beyond description. So that is the point. So, and what we're trying to reach in meditation is that very thing. So although you can give all sorts of instructions, you do this, you sit in this way, you concentrate on this or on that, there's this mantra that you use, and that you do all these things, but until you actually begin to sort of see the outline of the sunrise, the eastern sky becomes slightly lighter, and you understand, yes, there is such a thing as a sun, and there is an indication that the sun will rise. So to complain that, I don't experience anything, this is impossible, I don't think I'll ever reach anything, is totally silly. Because even in the ordinary human experiences of deeper emotions, you can't describe it either to anybody else. Until they experience it, they won't know. So these Upanishads have this idea, but they give us little hints that if we think about it and begin to... See, the point is, in order to realize these deeper things, you can't stand on the shore and somebody will explain to you, you're somewhere in the distance and they're trying to explain to you about the ocean. Sri Ramakrishna has this example, the ocean is like this, it's so vast, it's so deep, it's so powerful, the waves do this and that. And you stand there, the only thing that can do is to arouse in you the desire to go to the ocean yourself. Otherwise, it doesn't effectively communicate anything. It arouses in us the yearning to see that ocean. And that itself is all it need to do. Because we can't, if somebody else explains to us how everything is, that still doesn't teach us anything about what it really is, but it should motivate us. And the motivation is the only thing that is needed, because we have perfect ability to reach that. Everyone can realize God. There's no entrance examination. Yes, when you get your... If you want to get your degree, you have to pass tests and all that, and some professor may say a qualifying examination for a doctorate degree, you can't pass it, and that means you have to drop the project altogether. There is no such thing. Everyone everywhere is fully equipped and fully capable of doing it. But it is totally silly to expect it to be done, handed to us on a silver platter. Because we're already that. And so if we're already that, if we're already fully conscious of what that high spiritual reality that pervades the whole universe, that is a unitary, infinite reality, if we're all already pervaded by that, it doesn't make any sense for us to say, oh, well, you have to give it to me on a silver platter. You have to give it to me. You have to give me this realization. It's already under our control. We just have to make that strong determination. Yes, it's under control, and we have to want to do it. We have to want to realize that. The main thing, Sri Ramakrishna put enormous emphasis on this idea, the main thing in spiritual progress is yearning. You have to really yearn for it. I really want it. Well, we yearn for this, but we also yearn for so many other things. And as long as that yearning is divided, the results will also be divided. And it'll be unsatisfactory, and you will say, oh, I've struggled for so many years, I haven't realized anything, there's nothing to it, forget it. Well, that's fine, go ahead. But you can't avoid it, because we will be born again and again until we realize it. That is the one fact that these great people tell us. The Bhagavad Gita clearly explains that there is nothing that you cannot avoid the realization of God. Oh, I enjoy this world, and I'm not worried about all these other things. Yeah, that's fine. That'll go on for a while, but you'll get tired of it, and then this will be, again, the only option. We have no option except to realize God. That's our destiny. And if we delay it, that's fine, but it's there. And there is no other goal. There's no other goal, because once you accept the theory of reincarnation, there can be no solution unless you realize God. There's no way to avoid coming again and again and going through all of this, some of which is pleasant, some of which is not pleasant, but all of which is indeterminate. If we're tired of this indeterminacy, we have to aim for spiritual realization, for the spiritual goal. Eventually, there's no other, we will simply not be released from this until that is realized. That is the terrible thing about the theory of reincarnation. See, if it weren't for that, we could say, well, forget it, it's all right, I'm not terribly interested. This life I will spend like this. And then, well, I don't know what then, but nevertheless, it's fine. But the very nature of things is that we will have to go through this again and again until we reach that goal of understanding that there is no place to go, that there's no goal to attain. We have already achieved everything that is, not only achieved, we are already by our own nature, we are everything that we seek. So the question is only realizing it. And until we realize it, we will have to do this thing again and again. So now, as far as the Chandogya Upanishad is concerned, one of the best ways of explaining this, what we're in, is this very simple analogy. If you have various things made of gold, necklace, an ornament of some sort, a bracelet, they're all made of pure gold. How do you describe them? They have a name, they have a form, and they have a function. But those are superficial characteristics. At heart, at essence, they're just gold. So how do you think of human beings or animals or anything in this universe? It has name, form, and function. And Satchidananda. It has existence, consciousness, bliss. In other words, it is Brahman. It is that reality that is described by these terms, existence, consciousness, bliss. Existence means it is always existing. Consciousness means it is consciousness itself. That is never clouded, never blocked. And Ananda, we are full of joy. We are not full of joy, we are joy itself. So this is the essence. And then the name, form, and function are different. So this is gold made up of so many different, shaped in so many different ways. It has a different form. It has a different function. Because some of it is used for a gold bracelet, gold earring, gold necklace. They are all different. Some people eat off plates of gold, maybe. So name, form, and function are different, but the essence is all gold. So we are all different. Our names, our forms, and our functions are totally different. But the essence of us is that gold. And that is the origin of the idea of meditation. The meditation is not to make us aware of something we aren't aware of already. Our own nature, in meditation, we're simply subduing the names, forms, and functions, and feeling the presence of the gold within. Normally we think of ourselves as a form with a name and a function, and different things associated with that. If we can stop that, or if we can subdue that and concentrate on the essence that we are, that is meditation. And what is this essence that we are? We have to feel within ourselves the presence of God, the presence of the infinite, the presence of the eternal. That is meditation. Now you say, well, I don't know how to do that. But really, we do know how to do that. We need a certain hints from spiritual teachers. So we go to the Upanishads, we go to the Bible, we go to the Bhagavad Gita, we go to all these scriptures to get an idea. But we can actually feel that reality within us. We can never feel that we will die. Because we are always aware that within us there is a reality that it has never come into existence and can never disappear. So knowing that, we can imagine, yes, this body will go, of course. That we understand fully. The mind can be confused and distracted, and maybe the mind will go. Will not be able to think properly. But at the heart of the body and the mind, there is something which, though it may be unconscious for some time, can never disappear. It's unconscious every day. When we go into deep sleep, we're not conscious of anything. The body has gone, so obviously the body is not essential to us. The mind is gone. We're not thinking of anything. So the mind is not essential to us. But we wake up. And the next morning we gleefully grab the body and grab the mind and do all of our delightful things, which sometimes turn less delightful. And we think that that is our essence. The body is our essence. The mind is our essence. Yes, I'm so intelligent. I pass so many exams and I can do so many things. And then after some time, you find the mind isn't that intelligent anymore and we get terribly dejected. But the body and the mind, where are they? Every day we get rid of them. And yet that is our happiest time. That is the time we really enjoy. If we don't get a good night's sleep means unconsciousness. If we are not unconscious of this universe for some time every day, after a while we get terribly disturbed. Oh, I can't sleep, and I take this medicine, that medicine, just in order to achieve unconsciousness. Why are we struggling so hard to become unconscious? Isn't that a terrible contradiction? No, it's a reflection of our true nature. Our true nature has nothing to do with this body, and it has nothing to do with this mind. Our true nature is infinite, eternal, indescribable. It is existence. It is consciousness itself. It is bliss itself. It is, we cannot put any name on it. So these are the things that we try to remember when we attempt to go beneath the chaotic surface of this life, the contradictory nature of this life. We try to go beneath that surface and find that foundation, that basis, which is supposed to be that eternal reality. So this Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, it does this in a number of different ways. And one of these, but all these ways are related to this principle that at the heart of things, at the heart of everything, there is something which doesn't change. At the heart of every observation, at the heart of every inanimate thing, everything in this universe, what is at the heart of things? At the heart of things is our own consciousness. Because it's in our own consciousness that we see this universe. So this whole universe really arises and disappears. It disappears every night. But it arises initially and disappears initially within our own consciousness. So when we sit for meditation, we can begin to absorb that idea that really there is within me, the reality within me is something that has nothing to do with this body, and it has nothing to do with the mind, it has nothing to do with the world. That doesn't mean we stop working in the world and helping and producing and all of that. We can do all of that. But while we're doing everything that we need to do, we should remember that everything floats on a reality which never changes, which is the essence of everything. Scientists have been trying to discover what is the essence of matter. And there's no conclusion because they can't come to the end of it in a material sense. But the essence of matter is the awareness that we have of matter. How do we know matter exists? Because we're aware of it. So it's in our awareness, in our consciousness, that all these things arise and all these things disappear. Schrödinger, the very well-known physicist who was very instrumental in the development of the quantum theory and all of these strange things that physics talks about nowadays, he of course, whether he knew what he was referring to or not, we can just surmise. He said, ultimately, it may be that consciousness is everything. The fundamental reality may be consciousness. And, of course, that is what the Upanishads have been saying all along, that there is a reality here. Sadeva somya idam agra asit. Agre, in the beginning. What was it that existed in the beginning? And sat, existence or consciousness, chit, and ananda. These are three different ways of describing that reality. So everything is floating on that. And everything appears and disappears with that as its basis. So when we sit in meditation, we can think of that, not whatever our object of meditation is, whatever our inspiration is that we are meditating on. If we meditate upon it as a material object, that has its advantages. But if we meditate on that, like for instance, some people will meditate on Jesus, some people will meditate on Buddha or on Rama or Krishna or different deities. What is the purpose of that? The purpose is to convince this very difficult to convince mind to think, to absorb itself in the essence of things, to absorb itself in consciousness itself, rather than the name, form, and function. Everything we do, always name, form, and function seems to be surrounding it. But that name, form, and function, although it's extremely useful and extremely necessary in the daily activities of our life, meditation is not about meditating on the daily activities of life. Meditation is trying to get to that ultimate essence that is the source of us and the source of everything else. So meditation has to somehow evoke in us that idea of the essence of things. Not the name, not the form, not the function. Everything that has name, form, and function also has another quality, essence. You cannot say that anything does not have, that there's no essence. It's only name, form, and function. What is the essence of all these ornaments made of gold? The essence is the gold. Name, form, and function are different. So everything within us, all of our thought and all our thoughts and ideas and expressions and observations and everything in this universe, which has name, form, and function, also has essence. And the essence is not protons, neutrons, electrons, molecules, and whatever. The essence of everything is that consciousness, is reality. Now that consciousness can be, the name, form, and function can be extremely useful. They can be made to reveal their basis, to reveal that consciousness. Name, form, and function, give it the name, form, and function of Jesus, or Buddha, or Sri Ramakrishna, or any holy personality. Why? Because those holy personalities had basically transcended their own names and forms and functions. They became one with the infinite. So when we focus on those particular forms and the holy associations that these call to mind, we are not able to see the essence. So we concentrate on the name, form, and function. But by concentrating on those entities, those people, those beings who had gone beyond the idea of name, form, and function as being essential to them, had gone to the heart of things, had gone to their own core reality, by concentrating on the name, form, and function, we're also automatically getting the benefit of the things that they realized. And so we also, that reality is also called to mind. That's one thing. Another thing is to feel the presence of God. Feeling the presence of the infinite. All right, I don't see it, I don't have the evidence, but I feel the presence, that there is a reality. And I feel that presence. So when I go beyond the surface, when I try to probe into the depths of things in this way, then that slowly becomes more real to me. And eventually, since that thing is really there, as all of the holy people have told us, that truth is really there. If we gnaw at it that way, you could say, eventually we can get a glimpse of that too. And when do we get a glimpse of it? When our mind becomes unattached from its finiteness. Within our mind is that infinity already. We are, that infinite is a reality for us right now. There's nothing we have to do and nothing we have to become to realize the infinite or to be the infinite, to feel the presence of that reality. There's nothing we have to do except concentrate on that, except want it, except desire it, yearn for it. Sri Ramakrishna put huge emphasis on yearning. So this is something, this is not something that is so terribly different. Oh yeah, all the bells and whistles, okay, you know, you read of the experiences of the great souls about whom one writes, yes, they experience this and they experience that, all the bells and whistles. Okay, that, may or may not, whatever, it doesn't really matter. We may not get to the, you know, all the flashing things. But to feel the presence of God within us is available to us all. Yeah, there's nothing much one has to do because that is our own nature. We just have to want it. We just have to want to concentrate on that. So, searching for the eternal, that was the title. But really, in a way, the eternal is searching for us. You know, this is the peculiar thing about it is we feel ourselves to be limited, finite beings that are subject to this and that and the other and limited by this, that and the other. And we want to go beyond our limitations. We want to find our true nature. We want to do this and that. But that reality, which is all consciousness, all purity, all joy, is actually trying to manifest all the time within us. It is trying to find us more than we're trying to find it. Because our attempt to find it often goes astray. Oh, yeah, suddenly we see something here, and we concentrate terribly intensely on that. But that our own true nature is trying to manifest itself all the time. That's why we want to come back and do this again and again, because we haven't finished our job. when we finish our job, sarvameva avishanti, they enter into the all, into everything. They merge in the infinite and eternal. Although they're special beings, Sri Ramakrishna said he would not merge into the infinite and the eternal. He was the manager of this world's estate. He said the manager of an estate can never relinquish his responsibility. Anything that happens anywhere in the estate, the manager gets called to take care of it. So, you see, we can become free. We can become the infinite and the eternal. But according to this view, these great souls cannot. they have volunteered for this. This in Buddhism is called the Bodhisattva ideal. The Bodhisattva takes a vow that until all are liberated, until all enter nirvana, he will not. He will hold himself back. He or she will hold themselves back. Anyway, these are all tremendous, wonderful and inspiring ideas, but the basic thing that we should remember is that reality isn't something we have to reach. It's something we have to feel the existence of. It is already there. And if it were not already there, if the infinite and the eternal is not already there, there's nothing that can make it appear. So that is the point. It is already there. That which we are seeking is actually seeking us. Thank you.